every Arizona homeowner's best friend.
Come on around back, Arizona, Saturday morning, 8 o'clock, the outdoor living hour of Rosie on the House, your Saturday morning tradition since 1988. First Saturday of the month already. Outdoor Living Hour, so we're talking farm fresh commodities. We have Julie Murphy with the Arizona Farm Bureau in studio, as always, with special guests joining us by phone today. We're talking AZ Climate and Agriculture, if you're following along in your Rosie on the House Homeowner Handbook Calendar Guide. What AZ Climate and Agriculture? You know, yes. This kind of seems like we're getting into the five C's here.
Oh, close. We're going to talk about two elements that make our agriculture in the state so productive. You know, we like to say in Arizona, our farmers say this often, is farmers plant and harvest every month of the year. So 12 months of the year, there's something being planted, there's something being harvested. And, you know, most states, with probably the exception of California, can't say that, because in the Midwest, you've got these pretty deep-seated winters. So they're not getting to it. You know, they're still taking care of their livestock. They're still dairying and all that stuff. But they cannot do that year-round productivity like we can, because we have 300-plus days of sunshine. And the gentleman that I have on the phone with me is an expert in knowing all this. His name is Dr. Jeffrey Silvertooth from the University of Arizona. And Dr. Silvertooth, thank you for joining me once again. I think we had you on a couple of years ago, and golly gee whiz, when it comes to these areas and just agriculture in general, I call you my Aggie professor, so welcome.
Well, thank you, Julie. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the invitation to join you all. Thank you.
Just so, and of course, our U of A grads will know all about you, but for those that don't, give us just a little bit of background about you and also your work at the University of Arizona, our land-grant university.
Right. Well, you know, Julie, I've been in Arizona. I'm not an Arizona native, but I've been here since 1987. I came out here from Oklahoma State University. I'm a native of Oklahoma. I was born in Oklahoma. But I graduated from Oklahoma State University, and I was able to get a job at the University of Arizona in 87, in January of 1987. So almost 40 years ago now, 38 years ago.
And you raised your family here in Arizona, right?
Yeah, we sure did. We moved to Arizona. We had two sons. One was a month old when we moved here, literally. And the oldest, David, was two. And two children subsequent to that, my daughter and son, Ben, Jessica and Ben, were born here in Arizona. But all of them grew up out here. All of them grew up in Tucson. All of them went to the same schools in Tucson. And all of them went to the U of A, all U of A graduates. So, yeah, they're you know, hardcore Arizonans. And we've all been out here for almost 40 years now. So I came from the plains and came out here. It's been a good life ever since then.
That's awesome. So your studies and research has helped you dive into the Arizona agriculture's unique successes for these past 40 years as you're speaking. Talk about this.
Well, you know, Julie, when I came out here in 1987, as I mentioned, I was hired as an extension agronomist and with cotton specialty, cotton focus. I was the cotton specialist in Arizona. We still had those positions at that time. And cotton was the largest crop in the state. And so I was immersed immediately into that production system. But when you work with one crop in a region like this, you really are working with them all, because it's a system. You know, we rotate crops, we move them around so they don't just operate in a vacuum by themselves. We operate them in concert with one another. So, you know, what I began to experience, kind of like drinking from a fire hose, was understanding the complexity, kind of the mosaic of Arizona agriculture, how it changes across the state, from region to region. And it's really a different pattern than where I come from out on the plains, where you have more of a slow gradient across the landscape as far as the changing kind of conditions, you know, rainfall, you know, general topography. But in Arizona, it's primarily driven by our elevations, particularly where we're producing crops across the southern half of the state and what we call the lower elevations of the state. And so I had to become familiar with not only the crop production systems, but also the people and the communities. And even though we're growing all the same crops, everybody does it just a little different from community to community. So it's been I'm still learning.
That's
you know,
awesome.
As you probably can appreciate, but it's constantly changing, but it's quite an interesting mosaic across the state that began almost 40 years ago.
Wow. To Romy's point at the beginning, he said, it sounds like we're talking about the five C's, and obviously one of our most important five C's is climate. So on climate, mm-hmm. what makes our state's agriculture thrive under our weather? Because I always, you know, being away from the farm for so long, I complain a little bit more about the heat in the summer than I think I ever did. When I was on the farm, maybe it wasn't that big of a deal. But after all, 115 degrees in the summer seems like a tough time to farm. So
yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. It's a challenge. You know, that's the max. You know, we get up to those kind of conditions. But on the other hand, what people do out here, and we've done successfully, we can do that, is to adapt, find crops that are well adapted to those conditions.
Yeah.
That's what we've done. And for example, I mentioned cotton. I was the cotton specialist. It was the largest crop in the state at that time, 40 years ago. It's still an important crop. It's more of a placement crop in certain parts of the state, and it's a rotational crop in others. But it's a good example. Alfalfa is another good example. We have a lot of summer crops that are really hot, heat tolerant, they're salt tolerant, they're well adapted to the desert conditions. And if we treat them well in these kind of conditions, but treat them well meaning primarily well watered, good irrigation practices, they're highly productive. So what we do is we change the crops to match the seasons. We change the crops to match the seasons, the elevations, and the windows of crop production capacities that we have in Arizona, which, like you mentioned at the onset of our discussion today, extends the full year to every day of the year, 365 days of the year, we can be producing crops in Arizona.
And along with good climate, we have good soil. And if there's anyone that knows about our soils here in Arizona, it's you. There's a common saying that says we owe our existence literally to a 6-inch layer of topsoil and the fact that it rains. Well, that's for those states that get a lot of rain. We have to apply mm-hmm. our water via irrigation. But it's a true statement. So talk about our soils, because I think there's a lack of knowledge on how robust our soils are.
Well, that's a good point. You know, a lot of times some folks will say we not only farm our soils, but we're farming the climate. And actually, it's true both ways. And interestingly enough, soils are a function of climate in terms of the way they evolve on this, on the skin, this, like you say, 6-inch little epidermis on the surface of the earth from which we as human beings and most animals live from. And there's that evolution of that soil, the soil resources that we see out across the landscape are a function of what we say five basic soil forming factors, climate being one of them, that they evolve our parent material, our topography, our climate, the vegetation, we see the biota in general, because the animals and the plants together, all four of those factors operating together over time will evolve a unique soil condition. And that's pretty well established, you know, all around the world. But in Arizona, you see that these soils that we have that are evolving in this climate are very much a signature of that. And a lot of people think we have, you know, all we have is rock and sand out here in the desert, which we have plenty of that's for sure. But we have some beautiful soil resources, Julie, that are these alluvial soils formed from water formations, primarily in the valleys of the southern parts of the state, all over the state, but the southern half of the state below the Muggy and Rim is most pronounced, what we call the Basin and Range and the high mountain, intermountain valleys of the southeast. But these alluvial valleys have these nice deposits of sediments that have been evolved and weathered and then deposited in these valleys over time, and that's where we're farming. And so when we have these resources in Arizona, they're a function of that climate to some extent, the permacultural, that topography and everything, that the desert environment they grew up, they evolved in. But they have these beautiful resources that are highly fertile. They're highly productive if they are managed properly. And they have tremendous, resiliency and staying power. But the one thing about them are desert soils. So part of that climate is they're going to be high in salt content just naturally. And so they need to be reclaimed from salt and oftentimes from sodium, high sodium concentrations as well. But that's inherent with climate, with the desert conditions.
So it's fair for us to call our soil the skin of the earth. It's forming the surface of the land, and they're complex, a mixture of minerals, water, air, organic matter, and organisms that are basically decaying remains of once living things. So even though on the surface soil may not seem very active, it's very active.
It's alive.
It's alive.
It's alive.
Yeah.
It's alive. You know, it's one of the sources of the greatest biological diversity on the planet. It's right here on the soils, the ground upon which we walk. It's amazing to think about it, really. It's incredible. Actually, in the course of the time that I've been here, we talk about that 40-year, close to 40-year time span, and the technology that has improved with regard to our capacity biologically to identify, particularly through genetic identification, identify and separate animals and organisms and better understand them from a basic genetic level. That's helped us also understand the biodiversity that's taking place in underground. And we've known that that biodiversity is huge, but our analytical capacities have really given us a chance in the past 40 years to look into it, where that picture, that understanding is expanding so rapidly, Julie. It's incredible. You know, just for example, 1 gram of soil, average soil, 1 gram, one small gram, like a little bit of less than a teaspoon of soil, will hold about 1 billion different bacterial organisms, about 1 million what we call actinomycetes organisms. Those are organisms that when you go by a field that's been recently opened up, or you've got in your garden and you open it up, you smell that nice fresh earth smell. Those are the actinomycetes that are expressing their aroma to us, that fresh soil smell. There's about 1 million then different fungal organisms in 1 gram of soil, 1 gram. You just take that bacterial organisms, it's 1 billion bacterial organisms. Of those bacterial organisms, there's about 10,000 species.
Wow.
In 1 gram of soil. And one of our challenges is to understand, how do they all work together as an ecosystem? We're trying to figure that out.
And that's what we'll learn in the next segment. So stay tuned, everyone.
Everywhere you go, always take the weather with you. Everywhere you go, always take the weather.
Everywhere you go. Always take the weather with you, everywhere you go. I like that one.
Each university in Arizona, kind of has its own specialty, or it's known for something specific. And if you're coming out of agriculture, it's
right.
U of A.
Right.
And I've been looking for it. Maybe Dr. Silvertooth can help me find it, but I cannot find it. I had read a statistic somewhere. The oldest known agricultural site in America is on the Santa Cruz River, just outside of Tucson. Supposed to be dated somewhere near, they estimate, like 8,000 to 10,000 years old.
And what is that? Is it just the fact that there's been farming that long along that? Okay, cool. Well, I am so not surprised, because thanks to our Native Americans and tribal lands, and so many of our tribes and what they represent historically was agriculture. And since we're celebrating one of the 5 C's here in Arizona, climate, another thing I wanted to point out is that while Arizona's climate lets us grow year-round, I had earlier said we can plant and harvest every month of the year, our sun can burn up the soil's organic matter. And Dr. Silvertooth, this is what I'm going to ask you about. It makes farmers' efforts to incorporate organic matter more challenging, but doable. And in some senses, Dr. Silvertooth, because I hear this all the time, that farmers in Arizona get beat up a lot because people look at our soil and it doesn't seem like, if you're coming from the Midwest or the East, or if you were in Scotland and you saw all that organic matter that I think they call peat, well, it's the climate impacts. Talk about that. Why do we sometimes get a bad rap in Arizona about our soil, and yet you're telling us it's incredibly healthy?
That's a really good point, and actually, I like the point too regarding the ancient farming that was found here in Arizona. I've read that, seen that myself. So folks here at the anthropology department from the U of A have documented that, I believe. But those both are good points. The issue with the organic matter in Arizona is kind of an interesting one. I think a lot of people that would offer those criticisms, I mean, they may be well intended, but they probably are biased based on their background. We have so many people, probably like myself, that are transplants here to Arizona from places like the Midwest. And you have to understand, it's not the Midwest. This is a different place. This is the desert. And the conditions that we have in the desert and arid regions in general are going to be, characteristic for wherever you go around the world. And one of those is soils that have lower organic matter content. There's a nice map I've used in class, and I use them in presentations of the map of the United States that shows the general percentages of organic matter. It's a color-coded, shaded map. And basically, you can see the gradient very clearly going across the United States, Julie, from the East Coast and across the Midwest, the Great Plains, higher organic matter content with little darker colors on the map. And as you go out to the west, basically out to the Intermountain West, past the Rocky Mountains or from the High Plains onto the West Coast, it gets lighter and lighter, almost to the point of this particular map. It's white. And that's pretty much indicative of what we have in Arizona and throughout the western United States. Low organic matter soils because of low precipitation, lower biological activity as a result of that, and then lower accumulations of organic matter that are the organic matter is what we call the stable residues that are broken down from the organisms from organic material. So if you and I had a garden and we harvest a crop and we turn the residues back into the soil, that's not organic matter. That's organic material.
Okay.
And that organic material is then attacked by and broken down by the microbes. Now, there's a good indication of a healthy soil. It might look like it's just sitting there dormant. You know, you can't see anything, right? It's just sitting there, and you put some water on it, put the residue back, and then all of a sudden it disappears. What happens to it? Microbes are decomposing that material. They come alive immediately. And that's one of the incredible things. Those microbes that exist out here in this desert soil have the capacity to kind of go dormant when it's dry. But if they're given water and they're given food, organic material, for example, they gobble it up voraciously. So they turn it over really fast. We call that turnover. They turn it over into their own bodies. They break down. They die. They recycle. Those residues break down to the organic matter that we have in soils. It's just this little film of organic matter, but it's about 1%, maybe 1.5% in Arizona is normal. You go back to the Great Plains, and you're going to have 2 to 5, sometimes even higher percentages of organic matter in the top 6 inches of the soil. So that's what people are contrasting. But what we have normal conditions. And under this kind of climate that we were discussing earlier, it's just virtually, you can't turn an Arizona soil into a Nebraska soil. And that's not going to happen. And it's just a reality that we have to face, and work with it. And we can do so very successfully.
Yeah. And so our farmers are taking care of their soil. It's almost, to me, it sounds like just here's our Arizona soil, add water and a little bit of food, and it just explodes in life-giving properties, correct?
To a large extent. That's the thing about a young, geologically young, very fertile type soil, particularly if it's good physical condition. But it comes back to one thing we do have to do is we have to manage salts, because if you take the native people we were talking about before, they understood that very clearly. You have to be able to reclaim these soils from salts. And the way you do that is with water, is we leach. It's just like if we have, any kind of, salt crust in our clothes or something, you'd want to get them out. You run water through it, dissolve the salt, and move it out of the material. The same thing with our soils. We have to be able to maintain that salt balance because the environment, that climate, is driving that water back into the atmosphere to evaporate. And as that water evaporates, it leaves the soil salts at the surface, close to the surface. So we have to manage that constantly.
Thank you.
I'm going back to the earth. I'm going back to the earth. I'm going back to work. I'm going back to the earth.
On a beautiful Arizona Saturday morning. Thanks for spending time with us here at Rosie on the House. First Saturday of the month in the 8 o'clock hour outdoor living hour. We're talking farm fresh commodities. The topic today, Arizona climate and agriculture. Julie Murphy with the Arizona Farm Bureau is in studio with us with a special guest on the line, Dr. Silvertooth from University of Arizona, and covering a very interesting topic on our soils.
Yes, our soils and our climate. And
the skin of the earth.
Yes. And in fact, one other point I wanted to bring out, because of our climate and being able to plant and harvest 12 months out of the year, our higher temperatures here in Arizona are ideal for certain crops. For example, cotton, mentioned earlier by Dr. Silvertooth, because of that, it gains much of its growth in the hottest months of our Arizona summer. It's a long growing crop. Typically, at least here in the valley, farmers are planting right now, in fact, And they won't, here in the valley, they probably won't harvest until November. Now in Yuma, that's different because they also do the cropping of cotton in Yuma, but they plant earlier and they harvest earlier because they've got to get it out of the fields to get ready for, again, thanks to our climate that's so mild that we can be the winter lettuce bowl capital of the world because we can do leafy greens in the dead of winter nowhere else in the country can you. So on that point, I hope it leads into what I just talked about. I hope it leads into my next question for you, Dr. Silvertooth. What fascinates you the most about the Arizona agriculture industry, especially from your perspective as a professor, researcher, someone from the land-grant university?
Well, you know, you come here, I'm an agronomist and soil scientist. I work in crop and soil production systems. And, you know, coming here and being familiar with them in a general sense around the country and around the world, and having had a chance to work in Arizona, I think the thing that fascinates me most about Arizona is that it's intense because of the desert environment. You mess up here with water or with anything you do, and it can be a farmer's rapid demise very quickly. So it's intense. But the other thing about it, too, is that we have the capacity here. And because of the intense nature of things, it kind of leads to this. But we have the highest yields, the highest quality of crops grown anywhere in the world per unit area, per acre, or per hectare, however you want to count it. And that's fascinating to me. But it's also, it's a challenge because you have to be on top of so much. Farmers have to be on top of so much here in this business. And a lot of it's driven by the climate, the fact that we're irrigating and we're dealing with this kind of precarious set of conditions, but they make it happen. They make it happen very well. And so one of that's all kind of ties in just our capacities to produce, but also the intensity and the expertise that our folks have out here and how it has to continue to change. I've had a chance recently, Julie, and I think you and I have had a chance to visit with this too, kind of reflect on, you know, the past, say, four decades and how much things have changed. It's small changes, piece by piece, step by step, but it's all a function of that intensity that we have here, that people have to stay on the edge and have to keep pushing for greater efficiency all the time. That continues to impress me. It really does.
And my conclusion from what you just said is that our farmers and ranchers here in Arizona, and I know I'm biased, but they are the cream of the crop. So
they have to be.
Yeah.
They have to be. Unfortunately, one of the things that's changed over the past 4 years is some people haven't survived. And economic conditions, not only is our climate is somewhat unmerciful in that regard, so it's going to be economic conditions. And it's been difficult for some folks to maintain that as things have become tougher and tighter over the past four decades. And unfortunately, some folks have moved out of the business. And that kind of comes back to, you say, the public criticize agriculture for the large farms, big corporate farms. They're all family farms, as you know. But they've grown larger to a large extent because of the other people that have gotten out of the business and the incapacity for other people to get in. It's another thing, too, that you talk about that intensity and what our production capacities are here. I often say, you know, to folks, just general citizens, you just don't pull some dude off the street to come do this, you know.
No.
It's a profession, and it's a highly skilled profession. It's our crop production, and of course, I deal with it from the science side, but I appreciate the fact that it's an art and a science, and you have to have a skill. It's kind of like going into dealing with a surgeon or a physician, and I think something we can all relate to. There's science. There's a skill.
Right.
There's a skill in applying that science and applying those techniques and capacities. Our farmers in Arizona are incredibly competent in that regard, and that's something else I'm impressed with when I go around the world. I see that in arid land agriculture in other parts of the world as well, but see it here particularly.
It is just amazing.
And in California, by the way, too.
Yes.
Give them credit, too. They're good, too.
Exactly.
There. They really are.
When you first came out here, what's been your most unexpected findings and or experience about Arizona since you're from the Midwest? I mean, it's completely different type of farming.
Yeah, well, I think it's all these things we've been talking about here this morning, Julie. I think things continue to, it fascinated me from the beginning, and they still do today, you know. And the fact that we're producing capably and consistently and very efficiently, really, in a very harsh environment. It's incredibly fascinating to me. It was then at the time when I came out here. And I've been around irrigated agriculture on the high plains of Western Kansas, where I'd worked for as agronomist crop consultant before going back to grad school. So I've been around irrigation, but not like this. And that still continues to impress me. But, you know, the fact of the, thing, of the matter is, too, we're constantly changing and adapting and evolving. And it's been fun watching that. And it's kind of interesting to think about where's it going. Where's it going next? It's kind of always hard to anticipate, but you can count on it. It's little steps at a time. Sometimes people are always looking for these big, giant leaps in technology, you know, but it's usually the small incremental steps that bring us ahead. And that's what I've seen over the past several decades. I'm sure many of my colleagues could share that same kind of experience as well.
I feel like I uncover that a lot when I talk to my U of A professors, that they're just impressed with these incremental changes that you speak of. And then, you know, you have an audience every time you start a new class, and certainly a lot of the students you might have maybe come out of agriculture possibly, but a lot of them don't. Mm-hmm. What's one thing that you're always trying to get across when you talk to people, certainly your students in the classroom?
Well, you know, that's, you mentioned that right there, you know, when I was first here, you probably teaching in the College of Agriculture, crop soil science classes, crop science production, I would have students that would probably come into the class, I'd say 60-70% probably had some ag background, right? And as times have gone on, it's shifted.
Oh, wow.
And I'd say the past, I don't know, the last 10 years I was actually in the classroom, probably the gradient there, Julie, was probably more like about 10% of the students had, maybe less, had ag background. Over 90% of the students have no real, they might have visited Uncle John's farm or something sometime or another, but they don't have direct access or direct experience in agriculture. So that has really shifted over the course of my career, professional career here at the U of A. Talking to colleagues around the country, I think that's even common in places like, you'd say, the more traditional Midwestern type of universities as well.
Sure.
So one of the things that I always try to get across to folks is that, you know, particularly here in Arizona, first thing right off the bat is this business that it's a system. It's crops and soils. We oftentimes think of crops just to what's happening above ground and animals above ground, but so much is happening. It's all dependent. Like we started the conversation, we all live, all animals on this planet live on from the soil, from this little skin of the earth. That's where plants fix energy from the sun, and they turn that energy into biological energy, and we get all of our nutrients and all of the water that plants grow from through the soil. And all of us animals depend and live on that. So you better understand this is a system we're trying to understand. That's what agronomy or crop and soil science together. We're trying to understand that in combination with the climate and the environment that we're working with. So that's the first place you have to start. And, you know, you're out here in Arizona, you have to understand, too, it takes water to produce food.
Right.
And it just doesn't happen magically. It takes a lot of water to produce food. That's Mother Nature. That's biology. And we have to work with that.
So I'm not trying to get controversial here, but we hear a lot about biodynamic farming. And that's what we all have to, we're told that that's what we all have to convert to. It is a method of farming that aspires to generate its own fertility through composting, integrating animals, cover cropping, and more. Is that the future of farming? Is that the method that has to be converted? Again, what's your take as a professor that understands soil and climate?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know what it is? It's an old method of farming. It's the old method of farming before we basically the Industrial Revolution and before. If you go back to the way things were done pre-World War II in this country, a lot of other parts of the world, I can take you a lot of places where it's still that way today. They just don't have access to some of the technology, particularly fertilizers and some of the other tools that we have that we put in the field today. And so folks that are talking about going back to biodynamic farming, there's a lot of names for it, you know, agro-ecosystems, you know, we've been dealing with that for hundreds of years. So to me, it's kind of, I don't know, kind of ironic. I think a lot of it is an epiphany of people coming back to agriculture after they've been in their families, you think about it, removed from agriculture for 3, 4, 5 generations or more. And in the United States, in the Western world, around the globe, we're experiencing a lot of that where people are now several generations detached from agriculture, where you think that really never happened before. And they're coming all of a sudden with these epiphanies like, well, this is, we need to invent something new. No, it's actually old. But it's good. Those are good practices. Those are all solid practices, Julie, that you're describing, that people are advocating today. And most farmers haven't really forgotten them. It's just they're being incorporated into other aspects of the production systems. And our systems are intense, as we said before. So it's kind of interesting. It's like the old becomes new, and the new becomes old. You know, it's that rotating cycle that we have. But I think it's a generational thing. So those factors that we talk about with integrations of animals, cover cropping, composting, that's fundamental stuff. It's old fundamental stuff, and it's all good. It has its place. It's just a matter of how do we wrap it into the system we're working with.
And on that point, do all methods of farming have their place, especially in Arizona? There's organic, there's conventional, there's biotech, and now we're talking biodynamic farming.
Absolutely. In those categories, yes, absolutely. You know, that's what we're running into more and more. Arizona is becoming more and more a niche farming kind of production region. California has a lot of that too. If you look in the West, I think there's an abundance of crops that are only grown in the state of California. And so they grow them in these little pockets and valleys, and there's a market for them. But they're not something like a corn crop, soybeans, you know, wheat, cotton, that you're going to have millions of acres to satisfy the global demand. But you can satisfy the demand in the markets with a small amount of acreage sometimes that's highly productive. And that's what we're seeing a lot in these little niche farming operations if you get started out here. What a lot of the folks that I'm dealing with small farms, and you can't be painted all with one brush, so you have to be careful saying things like this. But I would say that a lot of times they get into the business because they have a passion about farming. They want to do it. But they get into the business, start farming something that they like, a crop, and then they try to find a market. In my view, it has to go the other way around. You have to find the market first and then try to grow a crop to match it. Farmers that succeed will do that. And we hear a lot of folks saying, well, small farmer doesn't have a place out here in Arizona. You do have a place. You have to find the market, and then you have to build the production capacity to meet that market. It doesn't go the other way around. The world's not going to change because you want to grow crop A, B, or C, you know?
And what's so neat is a lot of those small farmers are members of the Arizona Farm Bureau, and they have found their niche.
I have a funny story for you, Julie. You're talking about how a lot of these farmers have found their niche in Arizona, like Dr. Silvertooth was saying, and meeting that market demand. We had a chef from Florida contact us wanting to know where to find the Durum wheat
he listened to
on your podcast.
Yep.
When we talked about Arizona wheat, and we've covered it a few times, so I'm not sure which one of those he listened to.
Right.
But he reached out and said, okay, where do I buy it? Because he was looking to import a big amount to grind for his whatever hotel restaurant he is operating
natural
in Florida.
Yeah, and Hayden Flour Mills is going to take care of them because they do grind some of the Desert Durum, which is a registered trademark here in Arizona. So, yes. Very cool story. You had a question for Dr. Silvertooth, Romy.
Well, I was curious, how familiar are you with Biodome?
With what?
Biodome.
Biodome? I don't think I am, actually.
Okay.
Well, then we'll go on to the other question.
Move right along.
Yeah, move right along. One of the other things I wanted to point out about soil, because we've been talking especially climate, one of Arizona's five C's, but also the soil, because the soil and climate are so interrelated, 95% of food production relies on the soil, according to the Soil Science Society of America. So then Romy asked me what the other 5%, and I told him it was hydroponics, which, by the way, we do have a lot of hydroponic greenhouse farming here in Arizona as well.
Big tomato hydroponic plant out of
Wilcox
somewhere.
Yes. So
right.
And it's
right.
Actually called Biosphere now. Is that
Oh, that's it.
Make
Biosphere.
A difference?
I've heard of that, but I'm not familiar with that. I can't really speak to it. Yeah.
So
you talking about the Biosphere that's north of Tucson?
Yes, sir.
Oh, that Biosphere. Yes, I am familiar with that. I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah.
Well, I was saying, it's run by U of A. I thought he had some kind of frame of reference
about
it.
I was misunderstanding. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, Biosphere. Yes, sir. I am familiar with that. Yeah, definitely.
Of course,
that was the one that was developed years ago, and that U of A has taken it over.
And I was just curious, any of your curriculum, you know, does that ever tie into what's going on at Biosphere or vice versa?
Oh, yeah. You know, one of the things that's tied in, interestingly, there, we're talking about soils earlier this morning. There's some colleagues of mine that set up a landscape experiment in there where they can simulate climates and rainfall inside the biosphere. I call it the world's largest terrarium, you know, but they can take several segments in there and they can create different kinds of climates. You have if you've been in it, you'll see there's a tropical and high humid climate. There's more arid climates, et cetera. They can control that inside the biosphere, these different wings, different segments. And these colleagues of mine have developed some of these landscape studies where they're looking at the evolution of soils under different climate and never under different topography conditions. So I talked about those five soil forming factors earlier. They're actually studying those under these simulated conditions in the biosphere. I don't know where that project is right now, but it began probably 10, 15 years ago. It's a long-term study, but there's things like that that they can do in the biosphere, and they can see, well, what can we do to maybe modify or to improve these conditions as they evolve? But that's a good example of the biosphere. It's a good point. Yeah, it's a good question.
And the University of Arizona, our land-grant university, is always experimenting, researching on behalf of our agriculture state, and extension is that extension. It's that kind of connection between the research and practical application for the farmers, and there's some pretty impressive research that's going on behalf of agriculture. But, you know, we need to wrap up our Farm Fresh Hour asking you about water. I want to preface it by saying one of our farmers in Pinal County, Noah Hiscox, he said to me over a year ago, he said, Julie, I think we're finally getting to go into a wet cycle. And so he may be right, because last winter was full of a lot of rain and snow, and we have experienced it this winter as well. So what's your take, Dr. Silvertooth, and what can you report in terms of snowpack and all that fun stuff?
Right. Well, I'm kind of like Noah Hiscox. You know, we have kind of a feel for things sometimes, but I also will go with, you know, some of the meteorologists and climatologists are saying. I'm like every farmer. I think everywhere you go in the world, there's two things you can talk to farmers about: weather and politics. You know, pretty quickly. And so we all follow the weather and kind of become amateur meteorologists and climatologists. But we have been in an El Nino pattern the past couple of years with the warmer ocean temperatures, and that has been resulting apparently in these lower tracking storms coming in and off the Pacific across the southern United States, which we're picking up here in Arizona. We benefited from that the past couple of years tremendously. And now they say we're moving into a La Nina, as the ocean temperatures are cooling, so we would expect drier conditions. What they're forecasting now is hot and dry conditions to come ahead for the next several years. So I think we better watch out for that. But so I'm kind of thinking that's, you know, I don't know, a little more pragmatic, like probably going to stay hot and dry. But if it's turns wet and cooler, as Mr. Hiscox is suggesting, I'm all for that. It's just my suggestion would be that I'm prepared for some hot and dry in case, you know.
Well, and after all, you are the researcher, so, and the scientist and the professor.
I go with, we all kind of had to go by our feel sometimes, you know, how we live out here. But that's what the forecasts are right now with the meteorologists and climatologists, as I'm reading it anyway.
But I thought I remember on break too that you highlighted what our snowpack was in.
It's great. Yeah, it's in the Colorado River watershed. It's about 114% right now, I believe. But so it's good if we can get the return from the snow into liquid water into the river. That'll be great for us in terms of trying to bring.
Excellent.
You know, give us a little bit of relief from the drought that we've had for 23 years. It's been obviously severe, very severe.
Dr. Silvertooth, University of Arizona, thanks for spending your time calling in this Saturday morning. Julie Murphy, Arizona Farm Bureau, will be back first Saturday in May, and you're going to have a special guest in talking beef.
Beef.
That's what's for dinner.